Hi, this is Willie Wilson. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. Today, host Jeff Humfeld talks with 24th District Representative Judy Morgan and 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington about this year's legislative session, the bills that passed, the bills that failed, and the tale of two governors. Oh, and your phone calls in the second half of the broadcast. Jaws of Justice Radio wants to thank all of those who showed their support with a donation during the KKFI pledge drive. If you missed the opportunity last week, you can still donate online at kkfi.org. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Jeff and his guests.
And welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio this morning. We have a couple housekeeping things to do to start the show. Number one is to wish my mother, Louise Humfeld, a happy birthday. She's 92 years old today down in Florida. And also our condolences to Brandon, who lost his grandmother this past week. So, Brandon, our condolences to you and your family.
No, thank you. And I also like to say happy birthday to Ms. Humfeld.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You met her on her celebration for her 90th.
And for people that don't know, you would never see a woman in her 90s that's this remarkable. I mean, full of energy. I couldn't tell she was 90. You actually surprised me with that one. No, you can't at all.
So anyway, what we're here for today is to talk about the Missouri legislative session that just finished, and also a little bit of, like I said, the tale of two governors, the one that's gone and the one that's new. So first off, let's start with some of the bills that, you know, well, actually, first off, let's get an impression from both of you as to what this session really accomplished or didn't, and the overall tone of this. Judy?
Okay. Well, hi, I'm Judy Morgan. I'm state rep for the 24th Legislative District. Thanks for inviting me, and as always, I like to mention KKFI is in my district, so I'm very happy about that. It's right in the middle of my district. Well, from my perspective, you know, being a Democrat in the minority in the legislature, regrettably, there were a number of bad bills that passed. And of course, we were pretty well distracted by the governor's scandal from almost day one. You know, it broke, January 10th. We'd been in session about a week when it broke. So that was very distracting. Lots of people asking questions about that, wondering why he didn't resign. And it kind of hung over the legislature. But in the last couple of days, there were a number of issues that were brought up that I voted no on, that we can talk about later. And there were some good bills passed. One of my friends did remind me, you got to remember we did pass some good bills, and you do have to remember that. So there was good and bad that came out of the session, I think.
Yeah, and I actually have to agree wholeheartedly. It was a whole list of bad bills. I wish I could say that we did nothing this session, because that's how the majority of the session went up until, I want to say around the end of April, when they figured out that they was going to get rid of the governor, then they started kind of moving their agenda, and that's what we've seen from the rest of session. We've literally seen the last 2.5, maybe 3 weeks of just bills that they want, that they just pushed. And like Representative Morgan said, it was a couple good bills. It was a couple bills that I was a co-sponsor of that actually passed that I'm happy about, and as we get into the show, I'll definitely start talking about those. But one of those I would like to highlight for the audience would be House Bill 1350, which modifies relating to criminal history records. And we also passed, and I'm looking for the bill number, the bill for the 17 to 18 year olds being locked up with
as adults.
I was actually looking for the
bill. Age, so to say. You know, I guess the question that really comes down to hearing what both of you had to say to me is, do you think that the governor held on so that he would be there to sign those bills? Because he signed, 70-something bills or something or other?
Yes.
On his last day in office?
Well, I'm going to be honest. I think the governor held on until he found out that the big money folks was coming for him. Mm-hmm. I don't think the governor was going to resign, had any intention of resigning. And I think that the deal that he struck with the circuit attorney in St. Louis and the body, and I say the body because we have no formalized information that he struck a deal, but obviously we dropped all investigations once the circuit attorney decided to drop the investigation, he decided to resign. And I think it was all directed and tied into the big money, not the felonies that was targeted towards the governor, not the embarrassment that's happened to the state of Missouri by having a governor that had sexual rape-style allegations and then felony allegations for stealing lists and all type of things. Yeah, I think it was all directed towards the dark money.
And I would agree with Brandon. You know, it was like the House Investigative Committee that was actually investigating the whole Greitens scandal. They had subpoenaed, a lot of information, and they were really going toward the dark money. And as probably a lot of your viewers know, Greitens actually basically stole the list of this veterans non-charity organization that he had actually been running at one point and then left to run for governor, stole it and then got campaign contributions from them, and then also had another, whole organization in New Missouri that was actually going after some members of his own party. And I think he really got worried because at some point he was afraid those, like Brandon said, those donors were going to become known, and I don't think they wanted to be known. Mm-hmm. And I agree with Representative Ellington. I think that pushed him to try to make the deal with the circuit attorney in St. Louis City.
Okay, well, let's get to the legislative session. We will talk about the new governor a little bit later. We have some music we're going to play to introduce that and all, but let's talk about the legislative session. Brandon, you mentioned a couple bills in the criminal justice field. Judy, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about some of the bills around labor.
Oh, sure.
In particular,
sure.
And working
sure.
people.
Yeah. So, which labor, criminal justice?
Yeah.
All right. With Nick Shorter, and I may have messed up his last name right there, he was the actual sponsor. And I don't have the bill number on here, and I apologize for that, but he was actually a sponsor of the bill that would no longer allow juveniles to be held with non-juvenile offenders into the 18. I was a co-sponsor of that bill. I think it's a good piece of legislation, and it moved out of both bodies. Another criminal justice-related bill, again, would be House Bill 1350. And then we have... give me a minute. I'm looking on this phone, and I have them all written down.
Can I add something to age to 18? Yeah, that was raise the age to 18 was one bill that I was so happy that passed. You know, Missouri was only, I believe, one of five states that were still prosecuting 17-year-olds mm-hmm. as adults, and so this would make it that they would have to be 18 before they were prosecuted as adults. But some of the research that came out on the floor was pretty interesting because like 93% of 17-year-olds arrested in Missouri in 2015 were involved in offenses that did not involve the use of a weapon or violence. So a lot of these kids are, it's more low-level nonviolent crimes, and sending them to prison was not the answer. And I think there was such bipartisan agreement. This bill passed overwhelmingly in both the House and the Senate, so both Republicans and Democrats supported it. It doesn't mean that if a kid does commit a really, really serious violent crime, they could still be certified as an adult, but they would have to go through that process. They would not automatically be certified as an adult and sent to prison. And I really think that's a good thing. I'm really glad the General Assembly passed it.
Well, and we still, you still can be certified as
yes,
because
for
go through this process
offenses.
Even as young as like 13 or something or other
right.
in the state of Missouri,
and
actually, maybe younger even.
And actually, I think it was Senate Bill 793. There were several mm-hmm. different vehicles that it was, but I think it finally got amended onto Senate Bill 793 and got passed that way. Kind of, that was near the end of the session too, as I recall, those last few days.
No, it actually was.
Yeah.
The last few days is crazy. It's also another bill that I don't have on this list, but I actually would like to thank Chairman Representative Corlew because he helped me get it done. I have a bill that will remove the statute of limitations for victims of child abuse and sexual molestation. I had originally amended it to a House bill. It got pulled out of that bill in conference committee, and Representative Carlo actually put it in another bill, another omnibus bill, during conference committee, and got it done. So I just want to highlight that too. And Mr. Alvin Sykes is the gentleman that actually gave me the inspiration and the idea to file it. So that should be solidified now in law.
Good.
Great. That was one that I know you've been fighting for for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, congratulations.
So, and I was happy to get it done. I tried to sneak it out where I wasn't really saying anything about it.
Well, that's interesting because a lot of times, like Representative Ellington said, things get done because they do get added on to other bills. Mm-hmm. And sometimes as late as conference committee, which is the very last stage before it comes back to the floor. So.
That's like when people are on the chest and they pumping and they use a little electronic thing to shock the heart to get it to beat again.
Right.
That's what conference committee is.
Well, what else? What other bills? All right, Judy, why don't you talk a little bit about the labor bills
and
some of the things that have happened there?
Well, labor took a hit this session. You know, they've been doing really well, but this session we really took a hit. So I'll first talk about the anti-public employee bargaining bill. And this one, let me see if I can get, it's House Bill 1413. And it has basically three different parts. It started out with sort of your what we call paycheck deception, where it requires unions to every single year, public employee unions every single year, to sign up their members for both their dues checkoff that comes off of their paycheck and their political action contributions. Most people know public employee unions, they're voluntary. It's not a requirement to be a member. You are a member voluntarily. So it never made any sense to us that you'd have to re-sign everybody every year because they can already resign from the union. So it just makes no sense whatsoever. I think it's really just a way to take away the power of the union and to take away the voices of the people who are in the union. The second piece of it, will require every public employee unions to be recertified every 3 years, which means they have to go through another election every 3 years. And I do want to at this point say there were several public employee unions excluded from this. All of the first responders, like firefighters, police officers, nurses, EMTs, they will still be able to go on like they've been going on. But all the other public employee unions, all the state workers, teachers, healthcare workers, nursing home attendants, these types of folks who work in public institutions, they will come under this bill. So in this recertification process, what is really bad about it is that usually when you go into an election, the majority of the people who vote is the winner, right? It's the majority of everybody who's in that bargaining unit. So if there's, let's say, 1,000 people in that unit, that doesn't mean they're all union members because it's voluntary, but let's say there's 1,000 people, 501 have to vote to keep the union. If 700 people vote and 499 vote no, it loses. The union is out the door. So I just think that's a very undemocratic way. You know, we, Representative Ellington and I and everybody else who serves in that legislature, nobody gets the majority of the total voting population in their districts. I've looked at the numbers, and we don't. And we live in districts that are sometimes we've run unopposed, and you still don't get that kind of numbers out. It just doesn't happen. And then the third thing is, and I think we're going to be able to, this will hopefully be ruled unconstitutional, but the third thing is we cannot picket anymore over personnel matters. So I was a member of the teachers union. I was president of the teachers union. I can't tell you how many times we picketed over personnel matters. This will be illegal, and it will be grounds for immediate termination if you picket over any personnel matter. So we've our leader in our minority caucus, Representative Gail McCann Beatty, has already done a constitutional challenge. I know that some of us have signed. I've signed off on it. Others have signed off on it. So we're trying to challenge it constitutionally. The other big one that happened is, you know, the anti-right to work Prop A proposal that's going to be on the ballot. When we passed a right to work law in 2017, organized labor got out, got tons of signatures, 300,000, three times as many as they needed to put it on the ballot. It was supposed to go on the ballot in November. Regrettably, the legislature can change that. They changed it to August. So that's going to be moved from November to August. I think that was just about shenanigans that they wanted. They figured that November would draw more people out, and it would have a better chance of being, you know, defeated at the ballot, and it would also draw more people out to vote for people like Claire that they Republicans don't want to win. Then the third one had to do with prevailing wage, which will it'll weaken the prevailing wages laws in the state of Missouri. So those were the basic labor bills that were passed this session.
Okie dokie. They do not sound good for working people.
No, it's not good. But, you know, maybe sometimes, you know, we've just got to, you have to be pumped up. You've got to get out there and fight more when things like this happen. So I think sometimes when people get mistreated like this, it does prompt them. It gives them the energy. It gives them the strength to say, I'm going to fight back. And vote no on Prop A.
Vote no on Prop A. Okay.
In August. August 7th now.
Okay, Brandon?
Well, no, just following what my colleague said, this is the part of the Republican ideology I just can't get, because they talk about the Constitution, they talk about all this good stuff about pulling yourself up from the bootstraps, et cetera, and then they want to take away the very protections that allow people to pull themselves up by the bootstrap, or they take away the very protections that allow people to assemble and protest and voice their opinion and all these good things that should be protected, because you have the right to assemble, right? So when it comes to unions and the attacks that we're seeing on workers, I don't understand their mentality. Like Representative Morgan said, it's been very targeted. Some of these, I think, is going to turn on them, though. Like the August 7th vote, I think that's actually going to help the unions out, because now they can condense their efforts in 3 months as opposed to 4.5-5 months. However, I do agree with her on the Claire issue, because I do think that driving the voters in November helps Democrats, and it definitely helps out McCaskill. By having it in August doesn't help her, because she has a November election that she has to worry about, not necessarily the primary. But these are things that we've been seeing from the Republicans, and again, this falls back to the last 2 or 3 weeks of session, because most of these bills were stalled in the Senate because it was dysfunctionality on the Republican side when it came to what they was going to support and what they wasn't going to support. That last couple weeks, we've seen all of this pass. And my fear with the new governor is he's going to sign it all without hesitation. Mm-hmm. Well, I think Greitens actually signed.
I think Greitens already signed he signed the anti-public employee one.
Yeah, he did that during session.
And he also did he signed the one on changing the vote mm-hmm. to August. I don't think he's signed the prevailing wage law yet. Mm-hmm. I think that one's still standing out there for Parsons to decide whether he's going to sign it or not. But those other two, Greitens went ahead and signed. And you know, I've been I'm a member of a public employee union. I'm a member of the teachers union. It's a struggle anyway, and then for folks to just put more obstacles in our way, I just think it's so wrong. Especially to tell us we can't even get out there and picket I remember one time we picketed because the district had decided to lay off the nurses, and we thought that was really bad because the kids need nurses in their schools. So we were picketing to try to get those nursing positions back. It's not like we picket for just money all the time. We pick it for a lot of things that are really good for the kids. And this will actually say we can no longer do that.
Well, with the exception of state-provided services and departments, the state shouldn't have any business in what a private person and a private company does. So if I work at Company A and I have issues with the management, I should have every right to protest. Again, that goes back to the constitutional mm-hmm. protection. Mm-hmm. I should have that right. I should have the right to organize inside of that facility. And again, I don't understand their mentality on it. I don't understand the mentality of why a private worker in a private company is the state's business outside of taxation, right? We shouldn't be involved in this.
That's exactly, you know, my point, what I've felt about the right to work.
Yeah.
Which is they're interfering between the workers and the employer.
Yes, which is not our business. Our
exactly
business is for
right.
regulations. Our business is to make sure that we have regulatory laws just give you an example, saying six-year-old kids can't work in coal mines, right? That's a regulatory example, not necessarily what the coal mines guidelines is with the employees and what benefit packages the employees are forced to accept. That's not our business. Our business is state regulation. We should draft laws that are universal, not pick and choose corporations over the citizens that we serve. Like, I have huge issues when it comes to the union debate, but it's separate from just supporting the unions. It's more supporting the rights of people and what they can and what they can't do.
Can I follow up on what you both were talking about? Sure. In terms of the interference? I think you're exactly right in terms of the interference of the government and the private business of companies, because really all in terms of the right to work issue, it's all about unions and companies negotiating what's called a security clause mm-hmm. in their contract that says everybody who works here is a union member, because everybody's getting the benefits of the contract and grievance handling and those kinds of things, enforcement of the contract, the benefits. And so it's not forced on either side. The union and the company has to mutually agree to have that security clause in the agreement. And if they don't have it, then it doesn't happen. Then that company does. It's not a union company. Then they don't force anybody to join the union. So you know, that's the thing that perplexes me. Just like both of you said, is that this is saying to the government, we're going to get in the midst of your private business. And then the other thing that really bothers me about it is in states that are right to work, and if they do have a union and it's voluntary to be part of that union, then the union still has to represent everybody, mm-hmm. whether they pay union dues or not. That's the law. So if this happens, then somebody could not belong to the union, and that they're still going to have to, the union's going to have to represent them. And if a company and a union tried to negotiate a security clause, if this law ends up going into effect, they would be guilty of a crime, and they could go to jail and pay a fine.
And the last thing I wanted to throw in there, and Representative Morgan actually highlighted when she was giving the breakdown, is the vote. Right, so in my district, I've been blessed to get over 80% of the vote of people that are voting, right? That's not the totality of people that live in that district. So the scary thing about this is it's real easy to manipulate votes of people that aren't organized in the union to get rid of the unions or to weaken them even more, which is scary. You don't have any type of another basic example. You wouldn't go to a basketball game and then the people that don't like basketball that's not at the arena can decide if the game happens or not. That's what this basically does. It allows people that are not involved in volunteering or being part of it to decide if it's going to be there or not. And you don't have that in any other caveat of life.
Okay, we got a couple more minutes before we need to take a break, but I want to ask a little bit. You've both mentioned that moving the vote for right to work has an effect on possibly has an effect on the vote for Claire McCaskill and all. Let's talk about something a little bit more local, which is Lauren Arthur's mm-hmm. win in the Northland. Now, I do think that some of that had to do with messaging and the fact that people rejected some of the ridiculous claims that were made. Is this something that you look at and say, well, maybe we have a shot to make some gains here as far as the Democratic Party?
I'm going to let Jody go first. I'm going to be anti.
Okay. Well, I think it does. I mean, Lauren ran an amazing campaign. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But nobody was. I don't think anyone would say they were expecting a 20-point swing. You know, well, it was actually, I think Trump won the district by 5 points. So it was actually almost like a 25 because she won. You know, she picked up those 5 and then got 20 more. So she swung it by 25 points, which is pretty amazing. She ran a great campaign, but I think that obviously the Greitens scandal probably did hang over that district, and I think that did have something to do with the big win. I think she would have won anyway because she ran such a great campaign. But yes, I think we've got a chance. We've got some good candidates running, and I think as long as they can, if fundraising is part of it, they're gonna have to raise the money to be able to compete. But I think if with good candidates and being able to raise some money to compete, I think we can win some races back.
Right.
Yeah. First and foremost, I think this is Senator-elect. I was about to call her Representative Senator-elect. Lauren Arthur ran an heck of a race.
Yeah,
I think she put in a lot of work, and I think this is the silver lining of why she won. If we look at the numbers, we didn't crack 2,000 votes in that election, right? It was like 544, I'm a little off on the numbers, to like 600, something like that. Numbers is real close as far as trajectory. So when we talk about the Democratic Party, we mentioned Claire McCaskill. Well, Claire McCaskill has been having trouble that's been highly documented since February when it comes to so-called minority enclaves and minority votes. And I said all of this to go to the larger umbrella of the Democratic Party. Though we have candidates that can put together and assemble good campaigns, the Democratic Party, in my opinion, has little to no messaging at all for the so-called minority voters that it typically relies on for block votes. And if we look at the trajectory of elections from the presidential election from Sanders to the numbers of Clinton on down, we see that the Democratic Party is losing the mobilization method of that block vote that they so callously negated. So I think the future for the party is more bleak than what we talk about, because it is no it is no motivating factor to get people coming out. So we talk about Trump and we talk about Greitens and all the bad things that they have done, but those bad things are no different than the bad things or the neglect that the Democratic Party has done when it comes to issues that affect the so-called minority community. So I don't see any energy to make sure that we put Democrats in office in this August, or that we put Democrats in office in 20. I don't hear that sentiment from my constituent base or the community in which I serve. Now, I do hear it around certain candidates that we would like this person or we would support X, Y, and Z, but not necessarily the whole regime, which is a little separate that I see on the other side. Even though they have issues with Trump and even though they have issues with Greitens, they play a team style ball. I don't agree with the team style ball, but the Democrats seem like we're more fractured than we are unified. But Lauren ran a heck of a campaign, and I say
she
that
did.
Because she did what the party should be doing when it comes to messaging and outreach and all of these things that make a party inclusive.
I do think, though, that the Missouri Democratic Party did get on board with her, you know, for her campaign, and really helped her.
Well, they did, but this is part of the separation in which I'm talking about. So we have a slew of so-called minority candidates that don't feel, and I'm one of them, that don't feel that the Democratic Party respects or supports them. And I said this to representatives in Washington, D.C. I said this to representatives of the House Democratic Party down here. I've said this to local Democratic enclave members. So when it comes to the separation of outward support, I don't feel that a lot of so-called minority candidates and or incumbents feel that the party supports them, which trickles down to their constituent base.
All right, we're going to take our break and some public service announcements and our calendar of events. And when we come back, we're going to play a little bit of music to take us into a little bit of a discussion about the new governor, and then we'll start taking calls.
Now, the calendar for the week of June 11th. The Black Archives of Mid-America, in celebration of Juneteenth, presents For All the World to See, a nationally touring exhibition from the National Endowment for the Humanities on the Road, that examines the role that visual culture played in shaping and transforming the struggle for racial equality in America from the late 1940s to the mid-1970s. The opening ceremony, which will take place Saturday, June 16th, from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Black Archives, 1722 East 17th Terrace, KCMO, with remarks by Alvin Sykes, the civil rights activist who was responsible for the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crimes Act. The exhibit will be on display until August 11th. Mama on a Mission's Father's Day fundraising dinner, Dad, a Son's First Hero, a Daughter's First Love, will be held Saturday, June 16th, 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Margaret's Place, 7217 Troost, KCMO. For more information and prices on this event, go to mamaonamission.com/fundraisers or call 816-499-1214. Moore Square's 13th Annual Transformation Banquet, Radical Revolution of Values, is Thursday, June 14th, 5:30 to 9 p.m. at Union Station, 30 West Pershing Road, KCMO. The keynote speaker for this fundraising banquet is Reverend Dr. Stacy Spencer, Sr., pastor of New Direction Christian Church and the president of MICA, Moore Square's sister affiliate in Memphis. For information on the event and ticket, moresquared.org. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Now, back to Jeff and Representatives Morgan and Ellington, as well as your phone calls.
This is Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and I am joined by Representative Judy Morgan and Representative Brandon Ellington, and neither one of them are a white man in a business suit.
But I got to get that song now.
I got a better version than that one. It's a little, that one, we couldn't find the one we wanted to play. But, let's talk very briefly here about the new governor and what you may or may not know. I mean, he was out of the Senate before he became lieutenant governor, so maybe you didn't have that much contact with him, but
I actually never served with him. He'd left the House when I got there, so I don't personally know him. I know what I've read about him in the paper. He's obviously going to be a better human being, I think, than Eric Greitens was. He's not going to be an embarrassment to the state in that way. He will at least listen to people. I think he's already met with our mayor, Sly James, and the mayor of St. Louis City, and I don't think Greitens would even give either one of them the time of day. So I think from that perspective, he's not going to bring this cloud to the state, like dark cloud like Greitens did. But, I think in terms of his policies, he is a very conservative Republican, so I think we will definitely have some policy differences with him.
Yeah, I'm actually a little nervous. I'm hoping Representative Morgan is 100% wrong, that he's not going to mess up and he's not going to cause issues and bring drama to the state, because I hope he does. I hope we have another Greitens. Not in the sexual allegation standpoint, but at least for blocking the Republicans' agenda. But the reason I said I'm a little fearful, the commentary that you heard during session from a lot of the Republicans is that they wanted him there because he's somebody that the Senate likes. He's somebody that Republican House leadership likes. And in politics, when you have somebody that everybody smiles for, that's a little dangerous, because that means they have some type of alliance. And when we look at bills like we talked about, at least with Greitens, we know he was causing issues with his own party because of his belief of himself, how he thought he was more superior and moralistically infallible than the rest of his colleagues. I don't think the new governor has that issue. And he also has friendships with the old governor, ex-governor, Greitens did not have, which, again, in politics creates a trajectory of getting things done that us Democrats are not going to be supportive of.
And I would agree with Representative Ellington on that assessment, too.
Okay. We have a couple other issues that we want to talk about, but we do want to open the phone lines. That number is 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. Judy, you had mentioned the merit system for public employees and that was done away with,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, it was totally dismantled, the state merit system. That was like the second to the last day of session. It was Senate Bill 1007. The state merit system was set up in the 1940s for a particular reason. That was to protect employees from arbitrary actions, personal favoritism, and political coercion. It was to, stop political patronage from happening. So what it said is, you're hired on your merit. If you need to be fired, then you have due process. You should be fired for good cause. This is completely dismantled now. All state employees will be what are considered at-will employees, which means they can be fired for any reason. There was even a section in the bill that said, if you're fired as a state employee, you can make a request in writing for why you were fired. That's also been completely deleted. That no longer exists in the law.
So, in other words, say a new administration comes in, a party changes or something or other, the head of an agency changes over, it's someone from the different party, they could go through and fire everybody that they think is supportive of the original party.
Yes, that's exactly right, and that's the exact reason why we had it, is because we did not want that kind of political patronage going on.
Okay, I believe we do have a phone call. Caller, are you there? And would you please give us your first name and what part of town you're calling from?
My name is Malcolm. I'm calling from Midtown.
Right, Malcolm.
I'd like to share my observation and ask a question based on that observation. So
okay.
What I've heard a lot on the show today, especially coming from Representative Ellington, is that the Democratic Party of the Memphis is very fragmented, which makes it highly dysfunctional. and I agree with that 100%. So my question is, at what point do we stop talking about the issues using the kind of sanitized language that we use to talk about issues like race, racial dynamics, and the party, the so-called representation that we have that's supposed to speak on behalf of the communities that are marginalized, that are disenfranchised? At what point do we start having the important conversations like the one we're having right now, but use the confrontational language that is often missing from the conversations?
Okay, Brandon.
And by that I mean the confrontational language that makes people feel uncomfortable. So when we're talking about race, or when we're talking about wages, or when we're talking about internal issues that the Democratic Party faces, I think it's been mentioned so far in the discussion that you've had that the Republican Party, and I don't mean to make this a partisan kind of issue, it should be about democracy and restoring the health and rehabilitating the body politic of America. But if we want to make it a partisan issue, that's fine too. But I think that the reality is that the Republican Party is typical of uniting around and cohering around issues that the Republican Party claims to value.
Okay. Can we allow our
they use the kind of language that is necessary,
sir,
so that they're all on one accord?
Sir, can we allow our guests to answer the question for you?
I can jump in 100%. So the uncomfortable language and uncomfortable conversation, I try to do all the time. This is one of the issues that I have with the party, and then they try to, and I'm using this just being honest, they try to put me in a position in which I don't have access to people that aren't aware of the conversation being honestly portrayed to them. When we talk about race, when we talk about issues, when we talking about oppression, when we talk about using certain communities to guarantee votes, and then when it comes time to fight for those community issues, they're not on the table. But what I think is missing is actual action. So what I try to do is, when I'm in Kansas City or if I'm outside of Kansas City and I'm talking about any type of state issues or party issues, I try to always highlight the racial disparity to get folks to actually act. And in the community, and when I talk to my constituents, I promote more often than not that we should be an independent voice and an independent body. Because until we're in a position in which we're leveraging both parties, I don't believe the so-called minority is going to have any type of policy wins, because there's no reason to. When it comes to the Republicans, they know that they don't have to make commissions because we're already getting in the car. When it comes to the Democrats, they're not really worried about us where they're taking us, because they know that we're willing to jump in the back and we're willing to ride in the trunk. So I think the ultimate breakdown comes when we talk about action. And there's a couple organizations that I would like to throw out there, and one of them is We the People, which is a nonpartisan political action committee. And I believe that's the reason why it was formed, not to talk about the conversation, not to beg to get in the door, but to actually create opposition, which is an independent voice and an independent wing that's actually going to fight for these issues. And even with our top elected officials, it's been publicly documented that they had issues. I came out and I spoke out against Claire McCaskill this year when she was trying to get me to come to certain events, because I'm not going to allow myself or my constituent base to be, for better lack of the words, to be pimped and prostituted for votes, and we get nothing back in return when it comes to solid policy changes. So to answer your question, yes, we have to stop being politically correct, but so-called minorities have to stop playing. We have to stop sitting on the sidelines not voting, and we have to create our position. And when I say not voting, I'm not saying that we have to jump on and vote for the lesser of two evils. No, we need to create issues, and we need to vote for people that are talking about our issues, or guarantee that those that are sitting there are no longer in office by aggressively purging them out of office.
All right, Judy, you know, and when we start talking about working people's issues in labor, the issue that never seems to come up is class. And it kind of goes to the same thing.
When it comes up, it's just never addressed. Because I'll give you a couple examples. Right. One year we're sitting in caucus, and I asked for a caucus position on voter ID. Now, this is something that's simple, that should be a Democratic tenement. We can't do it because we have certain Democrats in certain areas that may have to vote X, Y, Z. But then you come to me, and I'm going to throw out something that I know I'm going to get backlash. You ask me to support Planned Parenthood, where I'm black and I'm native. Planned Parenthood said they wanted to euthanize Africans, black folks, African Americans, and you want me to stand up on the floor, and you want me to support an organization that may provide access, or that does provide access to women health care, but the founder said they wanted to euthanize it. When I asked you to support criminal justice issues, we got to support the police. Well, we're being murdered in the streets. So it's not as important for us, for you to support or go against institutions that are solidified in American ideology, but you want me to support an institution that verbally said they want to euthanize folks that look like me. So it's all type of issues that's there. They just don't want to address them, and I believe people don't address things until they feel pain, which goes back to the comment that Representative Morgan mentioned about the unions and getting people active. I think the Democratic Party isn't going to change until we feel pain, and Trump isn't enough.
No, I agree with you there. No, do you have a comment there, Judy?
Well, I am a Democrat, and I'm a member of the Democratic Party, and I do believe that we have the better policies for people. I hope we can resolve these issues, because I think we do have the better ideas. But if people feel left out, then they need to feel included, and we need to resolve it.
I want to give the phone number so we give some other folks a chance. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. Now's a good time to call. Go ahead, Brandon.
Now, this is a scary thing. It goes directly to the caller's underlying sentiment about issues. So if you look nationally and you look at the state level, you'll see that it's more progressive policies when it comes to criminal justice reform coming from the Republican Party as opposed to the Democratic Party. Why is this, right? Or they're doing more outreach to so-called increase the so-called minority enclave in which they have. I actually believe they are, because when you look at the policies that's being presented, not the talking points, not the feel-good sentiment, but the actual black and white letters that's being on the paper, we see that the Democratic Party has been unwilling to address the issues because they're not as politically correct. Because to address some of these issues, you have to call into privilege. You have to call into supremacy ideology. You have to start challenging these things, and we don't do this. And I have a whole list of lineage of issues when it comes to policies that I believe the Democratic Party should be progressive about if we actually care about the less than. Now, I'm not saying that the Republicans do, because I know they don't. They don't care about or articulate the separation of privilege, right? They try to ignore that. But what I'm saying is when you have a party that is socially conscious but refuses to work on these socially conscious policies, then you have to question the motivation. And I question both parties' motivation when it comes to so-called minority voters and policies. But I did want to highlight, which is scary, that they're becoming more aggressive when it comes to criminal justice reform, drug legalization, decriminalization laws, and all these other things that have been one barrier to so-called minority assimilation.
Okie doke. We are going to get to the guns everywhere issue, but we do have another caller coming in. So caller, would you give us your name and what part of town you're calling from, please?
Hi, this is Daniel from Grandview. Hi, Brandon. We did that interview a while back about social democracy.
Yeah, how you been?
Okay. My comment has to do with plutocracy. I think what we're really all up against is this idea of big money running things, making things happen. And can we have a focus on humanity working for people? Or is it all, you know, we're going to work for money, make money, and money runs and determines and is what really makes things happen? Or can we really have a focus of, hey, I want to help people, I want to work for people, and can we bring about that kind of a change? That's my focus.
No, I actually think we can, but it takes the people being active, right? Not paying attention to the institutions, because like we had on the conversation before, money's the root of all evil. And the governor's situation proves it. It wasn't an issue when it came about him potentially beating a woman, raping a woman, spitting on a woman, degrading a woman. None of that was an issue. It wasn't an issue with him stealing lists. It wasn't an issue with him hiding emails and text messages. It wasn't an issue with him coming in the Senate, cussing people out. All this stuff, it was an issue when it was like, hey, we're about to expose who sent you the money. So I think once we become, as people, we re-engage and we take ownership again, we get rid of the fallacy. I know you want to get in, Ms. Moore.
Well, I just want to say, I think there is a step forward, and it's with another initiative petition that the people got together. We don't know for sure if it's on the ballot, but they turned in a lot more signatures than they needed, so hopefully it will make the ballot. We'll know soon, and that's Clean Missouri. And that will actually do some of what you're talking about, Daniel, in terms of getting some of the money out of politics. It will limit lobbyist gifts to no more than like $5. And I think lobbyist gifts are one of the problems we have with government right now. It will limit campaign contributions. It will put up it'll have a nonpartisan redistricting committee to redistrict our congressional and state rep and state house seats. So I think that would be a step forward. That's going to be on the ballot in November. If it gets enough signatures, and I'm pretty confident that it has. So I think that's a step forward. It still won't take care of Citizens United. We've got to approach that from another way, the one that allows all the dark money. But at least Clean Missouri is a step forward in terms of getting some of the money out of politics.
Okay. One of the issues that we had brought up during the break was the guns everywhere bill, and that's a euphemism, so to say.
Yeah, right.
Judy, why don't you explain what that bill is and what happened to it?
Yeah, sure. It was House Bill 1936, and it actually would have allowed individuals to conceal and carry weapons in a lot of places where it's now illegal to do so. Places like public college campuses, bars, city buses, churches, election precincts, child care facilities, casinos, hospitals accessible to the public, and any gated area of an amusement park, which might have also included zoos. So people would have been able to conceal and carry weapons in all of those places that now it's illegal to do so. It actually did have a hearing. I have to say Moms Demand Action, which is a national group, but we have a really active chapter here in Kansas City. It's a group of folks wanting to bring about common sense gun regulation. They were out in force the day of the hearing. It was like, I think people were sitting on the floor. They brought down elementary school kids and high school kids to testify. It made it out of committee, but it never made it to the House floor. And I think a lot of what Representative Ellington was talking about in terms of the activism and the people really getting out there and making their feelings known was very helpful on that. We were able to stop that bill. And it would have right now, you know, I noticed when I came into this building, there's a no firearms sign on it that people can't bring firearms in here. This would have prohibited businesses from doing that. Businesses could have no longer put up a sign like that to keep weapons out of their businesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is where I get in trouble as a Democrat.
We may.
Because we have just a short time, so go right to it.
No, I was just about to say, everything that Representative Morgan says is 100% true. The only reason I wasn't scared of that bill is if you have your CCW, you already supersede all laws, which is scary. And I have my CCW. I believe in the Second Amendment.
Okie doke. Well, with that, we have to wind it up. We're to the end of our time. We want to thank both Representative Morgan and Representative Ellington for coming in today. I hope they enlightened everybody to the session, the governor, governors, and some philosophy as well, political philosophy.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Now, thank you, always.
Now the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Thanks to DTN reporter Doug McVeigh, we have the following report from the Patients Out of Time Conference in New Jersey, featuring scientist Dr. Melanie Dreyer. This is in regards to her long-term study of the use of ganja, marijuana, in Jamaica.
For their children, to keep them smarter and healthier. And really, you're making marijuana tea for your children 3 times a day? Yes, miss, it really helps them in school. Well, let's see. So I got funded to do a little study of children and comparing the children who drank tea on a regular basis and other children who didn't drink tea. And again, we found out tea drinkers did significantly better in their studies than the children who didn't drink tea. But it had to be put in the context of parents who were willing to share their precious store of cannabis with their children were also the mothers and fathers who made sure their children had pencils and paper and clean uniforms and went to school on a regular basis. But it was associated with good parenting and not bad parenting. And while I was looking at children, I was looking more at women and women who were smoking during pregnancy. And at that time, the United States was still reeling with the thalidomide crisis of the 1960s, very interested in the teratogenic effects of cannabis. And I thought, okay, this is the time to do a study of the impact of marijuana during pregnancy. And we tested these neonates. We used standard measures. We had 30 exposed neonates and 30 non-exposed neonates. And once again, the results were counterintuitive, and our exposed neonates did significantly better on every dimension of the Braselton neonatal scale than the non-exposed infants. So here we were, and this became one of my first challenges about the social and political realities of cannabis use. It was very hard to get that study published. We did get it published in Pediatrics, finally, but it brought to fore the editorial bias that exists in most journals and has actually been cited. A wonderful article in Lancet in 1989 actually evaluated various studies on not just cannabis but other drug studies, studies of substances as well, and found that the more positive your findings are, the less likely you are to get published.
I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike. And at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.